For the week of July 24th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 113, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And back in New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
Michael Giltz from The Huffington Post and others. Where were you, Michael?
I was on a tour of the South. I went down to Nashville for a birthday party with one of my best friends. And then I was in Birmingham, Alabama, visiting my family. Then I went to Atlanta to go on a walking tour of underground Atlanta, where you could see the lower levels of the city that they built up upon. And also had a great dinner with some friends of mine at a vegetarian Southern Indian restaurant. And then right back up to New York City.
Now, of course, another city that has a great underground tour is Seattle, but you were probably there to celebrate with Jack White of the White Stripes, formerly of the White Stripes, who lives down in Nashville.
We did not hang out together, though I did meet a guy at Yankee Stadium who lives in Nashville and had been doing all the graphic design for the WWE, including Stone Cold Steve Austin. And so, you know, you meet Nashville people all over the country now.
Ah, okay. Well, and more keep moving there every day because it is the capital of country music.
It is. It's got a good, strong, vibrant arts world in general. You know, there's some good publishing in Nashville, obviously country music. So it's a good media town.
Well, this week, the big capital of comic books and all things pop culture was San Diego. That's where Comic-Con was held over the weekend. And on today's show, we'll speak with two journalists who were in attendance, Jeff Boucher from the Los Angeles Times and Alex Billington from First Showing. The other big news story of the week has been brewing, well, I guess for some time, possibly years, and it's one, Michael, I know you don't like to talk very much about, but this week there's no avoiding it because Amy Winehouse died over the weekend at the age of 27. We've also got some theater news to catch you up on, and of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right, well, the number one movie at the box office worldwide was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 for the second weekend in a row. It grossed $167 million worldwide. It's at $832 million total and counting. That makes it the 27th biggest film of all time after just two weekends.
Now, we should say these are worldwide grosses because here in the U.S., of course, the number one film was a different film, which I'm sure you'll tell us about, but we should underscore worldwide grosses.
That's right. The number two movie at the box office worldwide was Transformers: Dark of the Moon. It grossed $88 million around the world. It's at $882 million and counting. It's the 21st biggest film of all time. So those are two very big franchises right there. At number three is Captain America: The First Avenger, which grossed $67.8 million worldwide. Almost all that money was made in the U.S., where it was, of course, the number one film at the box office. It was a strong start for the Captain America franchise, the fourth big superhero movie of the summer, and depending how you slice the numbers, probably number one or two, right alongside Thor and as well as X-Men First Class. And what was the other one? Oh, the Green Lantern.
Yes. We've already forgotten about the Green Lantern. That should tell you something.
That's right. And number four is Friends with Benefits, which grossed $18.6 million worldwide. Again, almost all of that money was made in the U.S., and it has perhaps turned Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis into movie stars. And number five is Zookeeper, but with Kevin James. It grossed $18.4 million worldwide. It's a bit of a flop. It grossed $88 million and counting. And number six is Cars 2. It grossed $18.1 million worldwide. It's at $350 million and counting all around the world. That makes it the lowest grossing Pixar film of all time, even as we speak right now. Hopefully it should pass some of the early films, but it is still a major disappointment, certainly creatively and definitely financially, because it costs $200 million to make. And number seven is Mr. Popper's Penguins, the flop comedy from Jim Carrey. That grossed $13 million worldwide. It's at $120 million and counting. Finally, some good news again after those three bad films. Horrible Bosses grossed $11.9 million worldwide, basically the U.S. only. It grossed $82 million so far on a budget of $35 million. Number nine is the Cameron Diaz comedy Bad Teacher, another $10.7 million worldwide. It's at $164 million and counting. And number 10, Bridesmaids, which is starting to move across around the globe, $8.5 million worldwide, $235 million and counting. Number 11, Kung Fu Panda 2, another $8.5 million worldwide, is at just about $600 million, which brings it right in line with Kung Fu Panda 1. So that is definitely a success story. And at number 12, Winnie the Pooh, which grossed $5.1 million in the U.S., and is at $19 million and counting worldwide, a modest little comedy, a modest little cartoon made for a modest amount of money.
I'm surprised that it's done so poorly. I guess maybe the marketing wasn't big enough. I mean, but Winnie the Pooh is a, you know, an international, it's internationally known, and the books, of course, have been read for decades. I'm surprised it did so poorly. Do you think it's because it's traditional animation and people just aren't, you know, it looks old fashioned in a way?
I don't think it's because it's traditional animation. I think it was just a small little movie. It's gentle, it's quiet, it's geared towards little children, even though the Winnie the Pooh books are much bigger than that. It's a very big franchise as far as merchandise and the books, but it's never been a big property as far as movies are concerned. They've never been that big of a deal. So it's not unusual for this franchise. The movies are not really where Winnie the Pooh lives. He lives in his stuffed toy merchandise and in those classic books.
Well, so do you think, I mean, it's a Disney film. Disney purchased the Winnie the Pooh assets. Do you think they have a franchise on their hands, or that's it? They'll just do one-off movies every now and again.
Well, that's what they've been doing, one-off movies every now and again. This certainly doesn't kill the franchise, if that's what you mean. It's grossed $19 million. It's not done yet. They won't lose money on it. It'll be a strong seller on DVD, relatively speaking. And it keeps the property in people's minds so that when they go to the parks or they're looking at the plush dolls, it keeps it a little more current. So I think it's fine. And it got pretty good reviews. The question is, Captain America, is that a new franchise?
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. That was my way of asking a question to get to Captain America, which a lot of people are saying has now become a new franchise with its $65 million opening here in the U.S.
Right. Well, you'll want to see how it does overall once it's done. But it's a good launch, and it certainly helps set up the Avengers movie, which comes out next summer. I know Jeff Boucher is on the set of that film right now, though he can't tell us a word about it, or he'll be sent into Marvel hell, wherever that might be. But it was a good movie. It got good reviews. It was pretty fun. I think it could have been better, but it was pretty good. Chris Evans, I thought, did a nice job. It had a nice square-jawed, old-fashioned feel. I imagine this movie probably trends a little bit older than some of the other Marvel movies, because I think the 40s setting and the World War II setting and the sort of wholesome corniness of it will appeal to older people more than the typical Marvel film.
Now, did you see The Rocketeer back in the 90s, directed by Joe Johnston, who, of course, directed Captain America? Did you see The Rocketeer? Because it had the same kind of retro feel.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
I did. It was not a successful movie, but it was fun, and I liked it more than it deserved. I think this movie is kind of similar in a way.
Yes.
It's fun. It's not quite as good as it should be. I think the action scenes are a little repetitive. The 3D was completely unnecessary. I was in a town where it was not playing on a 2D screen. I had to see it in 3D, and I didn't want to, and it wasn't necessary, so I felt annoyed by that. But it did have that wholesome earlier era type feel about it.
Well, this was a film that was retrofitted for 3D. So I had seen
this. Was it?
Yes, it was. Now, of course, it was shot with that in mind. So they knew they were going to retrofit it for 3D. So when it was shot, they were shooting it in such a way that they knew certain
things were going to pop, like the shield being thrown and stuff like that.
Exactly. That's precisely why they shot it that way. And, you know, Joe Johnston comes from a visual effects background. He worked on The Empire Strikes Back and with ILM, the Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's company, on the Raiders of the Lost Ark franchise. And so he, of course, has that techie visual effects background, and he puts it to some good use when he's making films like this.
Do we have any word on how much it did, 3D versus 2D?
Yeah, the share for Captain America's 3D was 40% at 2,511 3D locations, compared to Thor's 60% at 2,737. So if you look at it, I guess, really, you're right. You're basically saying statistics can tell you the story that you want to tell, because Captain America opened on 7,100 screens. So,
well, if you say it made 40%, that means 40% of $65 million was grossed was spent at a 3D theater. That's what I assume you mean when you say that.
Yes, for a 3D screening. Yes.
Right. So assuming that's true, that's, again, very much trending down from what we've been expecting. It's going to be pretty soon when we're going to hit below 40%. We're going to hit 35% or 30%. People are avoiding these movies. I didn't want to pay the money. I don't want to pay the extra bucks. I knew it wasn't going to be necessary. And I felt annoyed and cheated that I had to. And the movie was very, very dark. I'm absolutely paranoid and convinced now that I'm seeing movies shown poorly. I think they had the bulbs down low. 3/4 of the film was, it looked like it was shot at dusk. There's no way this entire film was meant to look, you know, dark and moody. I mean, it was hard to tell in some of the battle scenes. And even the quiet scenes, you're, you know, in the offices and people are talking, it was dark. It was noticeably dark.
Well, it's a dark film. I mean, he does, Joe Johnston, the director, does actually shoot kind of in this sepia-looking, darker tone. So you're absolutely right.
It doesn't help then if they're showing it with with bulbs on a lower setting, because it will only emphasize what his tendency is to do. But I think this was the way he meant the movie to look. But I can't know. That's the annoying part about it. We need people to step in like NATO and say, look, we're going to start cracking down and making sure theaters display their films properly because they're hurting the business.
Well, NATO, of course, works for the theater owner, so there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. So,
no, the theater owners need to get together and say, this is what's best for our business. We need to start showing movies properly. You know, we're spending tens of millions of dollars to have digital presentation in 3D, and we're screwing people over, and it's bad for the business, and they need to wake up and say, this is not a good idea. It took George Lucas to get them to start maintaining good picture and sound quality with his THX certification. Theaters would, you know, say, all right, we really want this. We need to do this again because they have fallen back drastically.
Well, it's funny you should mention THX certification. It's one thing that theaters just hated having to pay.
Tough.
And here you get 3D. It probably was a little dim. Of course, even if it's at the 4.5-foot Lamberts that the film is mastered for, so that's what should be hitting your eyes, 4.5-foot Lamberts, not the 14:30 that a 2D film would generally be projected at. The problem is with a digital cinema projector, and this is not an excuse, this is just a reality. The bulb in the 3D projector, or the bulb in the digital projector, costs $1,200 and lasts approximately 90 days, so 500 hours for most average cinemas. So that's about $400 per month per projector. It's kind of like a rent, if you will, a maintenance fee, if you will. Now take that and compare it to a 35mm projector, which costs maybe $60 per month to maintain. And you begin to see why ticket prices have increased, especially for 3D. It's not just the studios being greedy, but it's the theater owners trying to actually recoup the 300% price increase that digital projectors cost.
That has nothing to do with the fact that they're not showing the film properly. They've spent the money on the projector. They spent the money on the bulb. They think they're extending the life of the bulb by dimming it, and they're not. All they're doing is showing a junky movie.
Well, I think it does have something to do with the fact that they're not showing it properly. They're dimming it because the costs
They mistakenly believe that they will extend its life, but that's not true, correct?
Yes. Well, it does extend the life. It definitely extends the life, but the problem is it also turns your customers away.
Oh, I thought they were I thought it didn't extend the life. But anyway, it doesn't matter what the reason is. You're showing a movie. You need to show it as well as you can. I don't care what it costs you to do. If you didn't go back to 35mm, I don't care. I just want to see the movie the way it was meant to be seen.
You know it's funny you should say go back to 35mm, because I went to see it in 2D because I just wanted to. I happen to be a big fan of Joe Johnston's aesthetic when he's doing that retro stuff. So I wanted to see what it would look like in 2D, the way it was shot, without it being dim or the image being kind of darker. And I went to a theater assuming that they would have the film digitally projected just in 2D. Well, it was projected on film. And I have not seen a film in a movie theater on 35mm that hasn't been a show print. Because when you and I are in Cannes or we're going to see a screening, a media screening, those are all show prints and they're pristine copies. They haven't been, dragged through a projector 500 times before we get to see it. So this was a regular 35mm print. On opening weekend. And you really could tell a difference between digital and a 35mm scratchy, dusty print.
How did it look?
For the most part, it looked fine in most places. There were certain parts where you kind of knew the registration was kind of a little bouncy and it wasn't as crisp and clear as it could have been. And so I really felt like, gee, I'm listening to a record when I know that there are CDs out there.
Well, but that's just because they didn't show it properly. It's not because 35mm is inferior. It's because they didn't have a clean projector, they didn't have it registered properly, and they didn't do a good job because they don't have any trained specialists anymore who actually know what they're doing. 35mm can look gorgeous.
It can, especially if it's projected properly and you're getting it off of a, you know, you're getting a print struck right off of a, an inner negative or something like that, as opposed to a,
well, it's opening weekend. It's not like it had been running for 6 months.
Right.
And should have been filled with scratches. If there were any scratches, it's the fault of the theater owner, not the travails of 35 millimeter.
Let's move on from Captain America. Just touch on Harry Potter for just a second, because it had the worst percentage drop of any of the films so far, any of the Harry Potter films in the franchise. 72%. But in the end, and that's where I was headed with that statement, in the U.S. alone, in North America, the franchise surpassed $7 billion in domestic box office.
It's one of the most successful franchises of all time. And this one will probably be the top grossing film in the franchise. It will probably hit $1 billion. If not, it will certainly be right in the range of all the others, which usually grossed around $850 to $950 million. Very consistent, very successful franchise.
Well, now, the New York Post, Linda Stasi, and I know you write for the Post. I wonder if you, do you know her?
I'm not friends with her. I've met her.
Okay. Well, you know what I mean. Like, so you're kind of contemporaries, if you will. She asked the question in the New York Post, if Hogwarts, The Next Generation, would be a television show revolving around Harry's kids, and would that television show work? Would Harry Potter fans be interested? Could they do something a la Game of Thrones style, a TV series? Is that something you would tune into?
I'm sure many people would, and I'm sure many TV people would love to have that property. It's just a question of what J.K. Rowling wants to do. She was wary of the film, but this would be a TV series based on characters that she hadn't written about, really, so they'd be a little freer to do whatever they want. I'm sure lots of people would love to have that be on their network. You know, her column blithely said that the movie grossed $1 billion in its opening weekend by Monday. You know, so she's not strong on the facts necessarily.
Well, it's the New York Post, so are they
exactly,
ever strong?
It hasn't even grossed $1 billion yet. But sure, I mean, do people want to see a Harry Potter TV series? Of course, especially if it's not Harry Potter. Yeah, but it's strictly up to J.K. Rowling. You know, who knows what'll happen? It's not the end of Harry Potter. If it doesn't happen while J.K. Rowling is around, it will certainly happen 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now.
Well, you're right, Michael. 140,000 people attended Comic-Con this past weekend down in San Diego. I guess it was sold out. And one of the most popular panels was hosted by one of our guests, Jeff Boucher, who is the head of, well, first of all, he's the mayor of Comic-Con, so we should get that out of the way. And he is also a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, where he heads up the Hero Complex, I guess, website. And it's like a galactic empire, the Hero Complex, at this point. And you can find that at herocomplex.com now. And we're also joined by Alex Billington, who was at Comic-Con over the weekend. And he is the editor and founder of firstshowing.net. Thank you both for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having
us. Good to be here.
Well, Alex, you know, I don't know. Comic-Con gets bigger and bigger. It seems like the media presence is stronger every year, but they still seem to keep the fans first and foremost. It doesn't seem an event really geared towards the media getting interviews and breaking stories. It really seems to be that they keep the fans front and center, but the media presence is growing and growing. How is it for you to cover the festival?
It's pretty much exactly like you said. Just it's getting a little bit harder. I've noticed that for press, at least, they spread things out. It's not all in the convention center anymore. It's all off-site occasionally, parties at night occasionally that are promotion, and then a lot in Hall H, a lot on the show floor. It's a lot, I would say it's a bigger challenge for press to cover it because there's more to cover and a more spread out range. Even though there may be less Hall H panels, there's still so many places to go to. But you're right about the fans still being kept at the forefront and everyone's still making sure that the fans are the ones who get, you know, the most out of the experiences and the most out of bringing all the celebrities into town.
Do we need to explain what Comic-Con is for our listeners? Or do you think our listeners at this point know that it's the largest pop culture and comic book and movie and television and video game convention in the country?
Well, you just did it.
Well, I think you just did it, yeah.
Jeff, do you think of yourself as covering Comic-Con or real? I'm not sure what your role is there. It's sort of the way the role of reporters changes with blogs and websites and opinion columns. And now I think your role has changed a little bit because you're one of the attractions at Comic-Con when you're, you know, overseeing the panel for Tintin with Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson and other people. Do you think of yourself as covering Comic-Con or doing some hybrid business there?
Well, no, it's a good point. I mean, as soon as you step on the stage, your role changes somewhat. You know, for me, I do consider myself covering it, and I consider doing these panels, like, you know, at this one, interviewing Spielberg, as you said, or Peter Jackson, or also doing Guillermo del Toro and Jeff Bridges and Bradley Cooper panels, that, you know, they don't tell me what to ask, and I don't tell them what I'm going to ask. So I'm still, you know, doing a journalistic exercise. And in fact, I consider it the only sure way to lock in the interviews and access that I need to get to cover this thing, which is becoming more like Mardi Gras than it is like a film festival.
Well, now, did you know that Peter Jackson was there? Because apparently he came out and, well, you were there. Apparently you know what happened. But from what I read, Peter Jackson came out on stage after Steven Spielberg and supposedly surprised him.
We had all three of us had breakfast together, so it was not a dramatic surprise.
Does that include I was just saying, does that include Andy Serkis too? Because he was a surprise Q&A.
Yeah, no, we knew Andy was there and arranged for him to be the first question. He didn't want to be part of the panel. They were going to, you know, I think Spielberg came in with the idea, we'll have him stand up in the crowd so everybody can see him. And I said, you know, I don't think people are going to see him. This is Hall H. It's a little bigger than you think. So they came up with the idea of having him be the first question. But they had planned for weeks for Peter to be there. You know, you don't get those last-minute New Zealand flights easily. I guess he probably could. But he has obviously been busy on The Hobbit, but they had a break, you know, because Martin is on the set of Sherlock right now.
They're doing a new season in the midst of that. I thought the Sherlock Holmes British revamping of Sherlock Holmes would be delayed because of The Hobbit. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, they've actually steered around it, and it hasn't been a problem because since they're doing both films, there's plenty, even though he is in almost every scene, there are plenty of sort of, you know, more between the brick scenes that they can be doing and taking care of. So, you know, in fact, I have a piece that's going to go up probably tomorrow where he's talking a lot about that, because I got a lot of time with him before we went on stage to kind of get some Hobbit stuff out of him. And you know, and again, that speaks to what I was saying is that, you know, in this chaos, the only way I find a way to kind of come out of it with some really meaningful coverage is to, first of all, it's just completely limit my expectations. I don't try to cover everything. I just go, I say, okay, if I had a list, where are the five stories I want? And then I do the panels to try to get near those people, you know, and I really wanted to write something about Henry Cavill, you know, who's going to be the new Superman. So I moderated the Immortals panel. You know, I really wanted to talk to Spielberg because he's Steven Spielberg. So I moderated that panel. You know, and et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to give you guys a list, but I mean, that's the only way I can get my arms around the thing. And then, you know, when you moderate, you get access to them backstage, you know, because in the holding area and stuff like that, and it just feels a little different. But the only way all that works is because I'm part of a team. You know, there was three other reporters from the LA Times there. Four, in fact, I'm sorry, forgive me. There's four other reporters. One of them's usually an editor. But four fellow journalists covering the heck out of it, and that gave me some latitude. They told me to kind of swing for the fence, and that they would handle a lot of the kind of we can't miss this panel if we have to have some representation on this panel.
You did the panel for Tintin. What was the response from the crowd, Alex? You would know. You were probably in the audience. What was the response? Yeah. What did people say?
I have to compliment Jeff. That was the Tintin panel was probably one of the best panels I've ever attended at Comic-Con. Not only compliments to Jeff for being a fantastic moderator, but just Spielberg being there for his first Comic-Con and then bringing Peter Jackson out and Andy Serkis and the footage really impressing everyone. It went over so incredibly well. And even the questions, I'm sure Jeff will tell you the stories about. There's a little kid and there was a guy with a shirt with a message for Spielberg, and all of that went over incredibly well. And I think the entire audience was just into it in every second of it. And it's these, I think in Comic-Con in particular, it's those kind of moments at the panels that really count the most and really connect with the audience the most, the one where they are surprised, yet they're into every second of it. They're listening to every word that Spielberg has to say. They're not just lost in, you know, some actors spewing out whatever, talking about their favorite food or favorite color, you know, probably at the Twilight panel. So this is this is the kind of panel that I think works well with the audience, and it went over incredibly well.
Now, it was in Hall H. How many people are in Hall H? It's the largest space at Comic-Con at the San Diego Convention Center. So there's like, what, 5,000 people there, right?
Yeah, I think it's
there's 6,500 seats.
Wow. Okay.
And then there's more people that aren't sitting. So, you know, I would add probably another, you know, 10-15% to that.
Well, Alex, every year there's a debate about the mix of what is available at Comic-Con. I mean, I know this year LL Cool J was there promoting his TV show NCIS Los Angeles. So there are always some things that people might raise an eyebrow about. How did you like the mix of TV shows and movies and video games and, oh yeah, comic books?
It's always interesting to see. And the joke this year was, this is the year we don't have Avengers, yet we have Francis Ford Coppola and Steven Soderbergh at Comic-Con. It's always weird to see the films that they do bring and that seem to get the most promotion and just, you know, what pops up there. But I feel like, especially having just come from the crowds, that it's what I love about Comic-Con is that it's the pop culture sort of mecca for that weekend. It doesn't matter what it is. It's that you're a fan and that you're passionate about that property that makes you a part of Comic-Con, and you come there and you show your colors for it. You dress up, you wear shirts, and then you go to the panel and you cheer. And no matter what it is, the fans will be there doing that for whatever it is they love, whether it's TV shows, comics, anything. Like I said, it may be a challenge for me to cover it, but that's what I love about going there and seeing that, is that everyone who's a fan of everything gets their moment to love whatever there is there.
Well, of course, you mentioned Francis Ford Coppola was there, and I guess he was there with a film called Twixt, which did not get very positive feedback, at least not in the blogosphere. And you also mentioned that The Avengers was not there. This is a film that combines all of these action heroes from Marvel. Now, Jeff, would you know anything about that film at all?
No, I don't. I don't know. I've never even heard of it. I'm not even sure what you're talking about.
What happens if you reveal a secret about a Marvel film? What hell do they put you in? I mean, it's not the Forbidden Zone, or where would they put you?
It would be the Negative Zone. You'd be there in the Negative Zone, which Reed Richards discovered. You'd be there with Annihilus, and it wouldn't go well.
Yeah. I mean, the inside joke that we're kind of beating around is that right now Jeff is in a specific location actually covering The Avengers, which is shooting now, which he is not allowed to talk about.
Yeah, I'm in New Mexico.
Moving back to Comic-Con for just a moment, there was a lot of press ahead of the con, as it's known by insiders or by attendees, about how movie studios are not attending the event this year or are avoiding it because they're finding that sometimes showing footage backfires, like it did with Green Lantern last year, where they showed footage and everybody was so negative about it, or it doesn't guarantee success. Scott Pilgrim versus the World got a huge, some huge buzz coming out of Comic-Con last year, and it opened and immediately tanked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think that this is a trend that will continue?
How much of a new risk is it to bring something to Comic-Con? Has it reached a tipping point where it becomes the chances of getting too much negative buzz outweighs the chance of positive buzz?
Yeah, you know, I think absolutely. I think, you know, once upon a time, the fans would have been so happy to see Hollywood that no matter what they brought, they would just be happy. But now that this thing's sort of taken on a life of its own and rules of its own and expectations of its own, you know, what it's become is this huge, I like to think of it as a giant megaphone. You know, it's like walking up to a microphone on, you know, at a stadium concert with all these stacks of amps there and the crowd's waiting. You don't do it if you don't have something to say, you know, because these people have been waiting in the sun all day, or some cases all night. I went to the Doctor Who panel on Sunday, and I sat down next to these young girls who had camped out since 8 p.m. the previous day. And this was at, you know, like 1 p.m. in the afternoon. So this is a crowd that is so ready to cheer, but it turns pretty fast because, you know, they feel like they're personally invested in being in this room, and they don't want you to waste their time. And also they're comparing you to what came before you. If you go on after Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson, you better have something to do. You know, you better have something to show because, you know, you can imagine quickly the standard slide. One of the things I saw in the pre-convention coverage that I thought was wrong was I saw in a couple places, you know, I won't say where, New York Times, they were saying that just the Comic-Con didn't matter as much. And I think actually that's, you know, I know Michael Sipley, who wrote the story, and he's a great journalist. I think on that particular one, he missed a little wrinkle, is that I think it's gotten so important people think twice. I don't think that it's somehow, a flavor of the week that's gone. I think, in fact, just the opposite. It's the gun on the table, you know, and if you don't know how to use it, you don't touch it. And there's also the fact that Disney didn't go, the fact that with John Carter, which was, a big surprise to a lot of people, the fact that the Avengers went but didn't go into Hall H, and the fact that, Warner Brothers didn't take Man of Steel. You know, some of these aren't surprising. Man of Steel's been pushed back a year. Why would you take it this year, take it next year? We know that now. And as for Disney and Marvel, I think their absence in Hall H actually speaks to the importance of Comic-Con, because Disney has made their own Comic-Con. I mean, they have D23 in Anaheim next month, and they're going to, Jon Favreau's going to be there with Magic Kingdom, and Marvel's going to be there with the Avengers, and Andrew Stanton's going to be there with John Carter, and I wouldn't be surprised if Johnny Depp was there with Lone Ranger. So that doesn't mean that Comic-Con's less important. It means that Disney, who knows a good idea when they see it, is making their own Comic-Con.
Well, wait a second. Let's talk about that for a second. Disney does have its own little convention. Little, I should say. It has its own convention now called D23, as you just said. It really focuses on Disney properties. But now one of the Disney properties is Marvel. They own Marvel Comics. And that includes the films and the comic books. And that's one of the two major comic book publishers in North America, if not the world. So how does Comic-Con continue if Disney keeps pulling all of these important films, important comic book films, or important comic book properties away from Comic-Con?
Well, I don't think they'll ever pull it away. I think, in talking to Kevin Feige, and Alex knows this as well, is that last year the Avengers, had this thunderclap moment where, as a surprise, they brought out every single cast member. Well, the principal cast members, there's like 7 or 8 people up on stage, 8 or 9, really, with Chris Hemsworth and Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. and Scarlett Johansson and Samuel L. Jackson, just sort of paraded them all up there. And it was like a rock concert because no one knew it was going to happen. This year, they've been shooting for a while, but they don't have finished effects. As you said, they saw what happened with Green Lantern. They said, we can't compete against last year. We can't compete against ourselves. And their thing is, let's just go out on the showroom floor. We'll sit out a year, we'll do D23, and then, we'll be back next year with Iron Man 3. That's what their plan is. Comic-Con is too essential to Marvel for them ever not to go. But if this year those particular factors all sort of tumbled into place in the right way, that for Marvel it made more sense not to go. There was something they were trying to do, too, that they couldn't pull off. They were going to do a stadium. They were going to show Captain America for free outdoors in the stadium adjacent to Comic-Con, Petco Park. But they couldn't get the noise permit, and there was too many logistics. There was a outdoor performing arts. I think there was a Philharmonic performance across the water or something like that. So they couldn't compete because the noise would bleed. So it's another example of art getting in the way of superheroes.
Alex, who do you think made the best use of Comic-Con this year, and who do you think maybe stumbled, whether it's movies, TV, video games, books, or whatever?
Well, I can name two panels specifically that I think stumbled, as you say. The first one being Legendary Pictures' pre-production panel, which the first problem was that it was in the wrong room. It wasn't even in Hall H. It was in 6 BCF, which is on the other side of the convention center, and it only holds, I think, 1,000 people, if even. And then they decided to bring people like Jeff Bridges and Bradley Cooper last minute. So it became this thing where no one could actually get in. No one could get passes to get in. And everyone thought there was going to be something there. But then I followed the coverage as it was happening, and it turns out nothing was announced. It was simply just talk about their projects. Not to say that talk about the projects isn't good, but for something that had a lot of potential to be big, for example, everyone was hoping that they would announce Mass Effect, the movie, and a director, and potentially a cast and information. When it came to Mass Effect, they said, here's our writer that we announced years ago. We're going to bring him up. We're going to talk about the franchise with the creator of the game for about 10 minutes, and that's it. And they didn't even announce anything. They just sort of chatted about things, and that was it. And the other example is the Universal panel for Snow White and the Huntsman, which I thought... it was another. They were about to start shooting in a couple of weeks, and yet they brought the entire cast there, which I felt like was almost pointless, because why would you bring a cast there when they're talking about characters they haven't even played and they're just about to start playing? And I get it was they introduced the movie in a way that was different than the other Snow White, which makes sense. But those two panels just sort of felt like, what is the whole point of making this big show about it when you have nothing to announce or really show for it? And in the end, it goes against what Jeff was saying about people want to be there to get excited for something. Well, they have nothing to get excited for except for a couple people on stage. It can backfire in them. And I think those are two examples, not necessarily that Snow White backfired, but that it was just sort of a letdown, sort of, you know, why is this here in my mind?
You can't just show up. You got to have something substantial to do is a good lesson to learn.
Yeah, I would say so. And I mean, just look at the history of Comic-Con. And even as Jeff was saying with the Avengers last year, that's an example of a huge surprise working so well. Peter Jackson, another example of a surprise working so well. I think surprises and having something to show are two of the keys to make sure that presentation at Comic-Con is so successful.
Now, we should explain for our listeners that there are two Snow White films being shot at the same time, one by Tarsem that is being made by Relativity. It's being considered a more softer, more traditional version. And then one that's more like Joan of Arc that is being directed by Rupert Sanders and stars Kristen Stewart and Charlize Theron and Chris Hemsworth. And that is titled Snow White and the Huntsman, and that's kind of a little bit more dark. It's not the traditional Snow White that we've all come to know from Disney. Yeah. And so they're both being made at the same time.
Let's end with, you know, comic books. Why not? What was the best comic book news, or what was the best comic book moment for you at the Comic-Con, Jeff?
Well, there was a personal one. I only bought one thing at Comic-Con this year. I bought a piece of Jack Kirby original art. And nice. As a guy that grew up loving comics, to have my first piece of Jack Kirby art, that's a kind of a very personal answer. But I'll tell you that, because, you know, kind of, you know, it goes back to the thrill of what you walk out with in your bag is means a lot to you.
What was it? What was the piece of art? Was it Plastic Man, or what was it?
No, it's issue of Cobra, which 1976, Cobra number one from DC Comics, page 8. It was DC decided to start making comic books about villains. The Joker had his own comic for a while. There was Secret Society of Supervillains and such. And it's a comic book I've owned since it came out. So I bought it, you know, when I was 7 years old. And it was kind of a treat for me. And then, you know, sort of entry-wise, you know, to me, the really fascinating thing is how much anxiety there was. You know, DC Comics is going day and date digital, you know, beginning in September. So all their comics will be available online the same day they hit comic book stores. Retailers across the country are worried that this is sort of a cataclysmic moment for them, that, you know, they're going to, you know, that these comic books that are sometimes costing $2.99, $3.99, $4.99, and are still really, if you think about it, just glossy brochures, that the bottom's going to fall out for them. And a lot of them are already teetering on bad times anyway. You know, I mean, the economy is not such that a lot of people are walking around spending 60, 70 bucks on comics every week.
TV shows also show up there. I know we've talked a lot about movies, but what about the TV shows? Was there anything like, say, The Walking Dead, which made a big splash last year, that was noteworthy at this year's Comic-Con?
Game of Thrones, maybe.
Oh my gosh, I actually read that people waited 7 hours to get into this panel for Game of Thrones, the HBO
series. Game of Thrones, it was huge, and it should have been in Hall H. I mean, really, you know, Sunday this year they have TV shows in Hall H for the first time, but the ones that made it really made me wonder how you get in there. I mean, I don't know how Cleveland show gets in Hall H and True Blood and Game of Thrones don't, although I think part of that was that, you know, HBO didn't want to miss the press, because a lot of press leaves Sunday morning. You know, they don't stick around because Sunday's traditionally a dead day. So I think next year you'll see big TV shows in Sunday Hall H, and you'll see hotels a little happier that people are going to check out Monday morning instead of Sunday morning. But yeah, I mean, the big ones are the ones you would expect: True Blood, Game of Thrones, Dexter has a really strong following down there, because really it's, you know, it's basically Batman without the suit. And with some, you know, wonderful clinical devices. And then, you know, for me, the one I like, and it's I went out of my way to moderate this TV show panel I actually called up and asked if I could do it because I like the show so much. It's a new show called Alphas that I'm really enjoying.
Oh, yeah. I've heard that's quite good, actually. Yeah. Alphas is the name of the show. And it seems like it was a very successful year for both of you. Is that correct, Alex?
Yeah, definitely. The interesting thing, just to mention this, is that it wasn't, for me in particular, because I focus so much on movies, it wasn't as, it felt like a very quiet year. And I don't mean that to say that Tintin and Spider-Man and all these big panels weren't getting the exposure they deserved, but that in the end, driving home on Sunday, I felt like there wasn't as much overall over the entire weekend that just really blew me away. It was like a couple things here and there, and we saw a couple good panels each day, but that was it. It wasn't as huge and exciting as even the year before.
Yeah, I think Alex is exactly right. And and what's really interesting is to look at next year. And I think Alex and I were talking about this while we were down there. We ran into each other a couple times. You know, next year is nuts. I mean, there, you know, even without Superman, you still have Spider-Man, you have James Bond, you have Star Trek, you have a little movie called Dark Knight Rises, you have The Hobbit, Avengers. It's just, it's pretty unbelievable. So I think this was sort of the quiet before the storm. I think next year is going to be the biggest year in the history of these kinds of entertainments. It's interesting. I think a lot of people stayed home because they're kind of gearing up, and a mistake is too big right now, because next year, you know, you're only going to have one opening weekend and then not a lot of room after next summer because, you know, everything's going to be piled of each other.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Jeff Boucher from the Los Angeles Times. You can find his work at herocomplex.com, among other places. We'll place links to those in the show notes. And Alex Billington from firstshowing.net. Thank you both for being here to discuss Comic-Con. We look forward to speaking with you again next year.
Great.
Thanks, guys.
Good to be on.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Well, that was good of them to join us. From the happy news of Comic-Con, we have to move to sadder news. Yet another rock star dies at the age of 27.
Yes, I guess there is a club known as the 27 Club or the 27 Group of musicians who have passed away before their time at the age of 27. And so some of them are Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison, and Brian Jones, the founder of the Rolling Stones. And this weekend, I think a surprise to nobody was Amy Winehouse was found dead in her apartment or in her house in London.
That's right. We don't know what the cause of death was yet, though obviously everyone suspects drug overdose of some type or sort, but we really don't know. They did an initial autopsy, and now we have to wait for toxicology reports. Her father was in New York. He had a nice little profile in the New York Times as he tried to do a jazz club date. Obviously, those plans ended, and he went back home to bury his daughter. It's very sad news. We all have our opinions and thoughts on it. As soon as I heard the news, I tweeted that this is, you know, a tragedy we could all see happening a mile away. People who were booking her for concerts or trying to get her to record and go on tour and do press should take a long, hard look at themselves as far as, you know, their responsibility. But frankly, we don't really know what any of their family or friends said to her, what was done or tried to be done. It's just a very sad time. And, you know, she's a very talented person. All we can do is say, what if?
That's right. That's right. And I actually sent out a Twitter post as well. Ironically, learned about the news on Google Plus from somebody I don't even know. I have never
Google
met before.
Plus.
What can I say? I mean, I was on Google Plus or I was in my Gmail and something from Google Plus popped up and said that CNN or somebody, the Associated Press, was reporting that police had found Amy Winehouse dead in her apartment or in her house in London. And I sent out a post on Twitter that said it was one of the more preventable tragedies that had occurred in recent memory. I was surprised how many people retweeted that so quickly.
Mm. Well, you know, preventable is the question of how much you can make somebody end their addiction. I've known people who were alcoholics and addicts in my family and in my circle of friends, people who had mental illness and did not want to stay on their medication. And at a certain point, there's nothing you can do. What you want is to be able to say, I did everything I could and I didn't help them continue. But ultimately, she's an adult. She's responsible for her own actions, putting aside the fact that she obviously had a sickness and addiction. But there's only, you know, if somebody doesn't want to get better, there's really nothing you can do. But what you can do is step away and say, I'm not going to act as if things are okay. I'm not going to book you to play in my club when I think you're a mess and it's a dangerous thing for you to do, that sort of thing.
Right. And I know a couple of weeks ago when she did do the concert in Serbia, we reported on it. The next week there was actual footage that we were going to talk about. And you said, you know what? I don't want to talk about that. And we kind of had a little back and forth about it, not in any negative way. We just kind of said, should we asked the question, should we talk about this? And we said, you know what? We're not adding anything to it. Let's not talk about it. And so there were times where we had stories about Amy Winehouse, and even when Karen was on the show, we decided not to talk about them because we certainly did not want to add to the problem of people kind of navel-gazing or kind of rubbernecking at what looked to be a horrible tragedy in the making. And sure enough, that's what happened. And you just said something very interesting, that club owners and promoters and record companies and even television producers and studios could actually turn to people who are addicted and say, we can't work with you because we don't want to be a part of, we don't want to condone it, and we don't want to help exacerbate the problem. And that is exactly what Nikki Fink of Deadline Hollywood over at Deadline.com, that she had a whole post that not only talked about that, but then highlighted a post that Russell Brand, the actor, wrote about his friend, Amy Winehouse.
He's no stranger to addiction himself, right? Or drug use, I believe.
No, he's not, actually. He, I guess, even at the age of 27, was either an alcoholic or was involved in drugs. And I thought that, what did you think about, first, I want to ask you, what did you think about what Nikki Fink wrote? It was very interesting to me, at least, that she was saying, you know, the entertainment industry is not doing enough institutionally to stop enabling its addicted artists and start helping them. And it's a town that has no notion of personal responsibility, much less corporate responsibility, and that film and television business leaders have never taken a leadership role on the issue, and that really it's all about greed. They're not going to, you know, turn down or stop a film production or a television show production, which is making millions for everybody, to help somebody with a disease.
Well, first of all, I don't think the entertainment world is awash in out of control lunatics. I think most TV shows and most movies and most albums are created by people who are, you know, working hard and doing their job. It's the people that we focus on, like Jim Belushi or Amy Winehouse, they stick out because they're so notable. There are always some certain out of control people in the rap world or teen idols who are getting out of control, whatever. They make news because they're unusual. Most teen idols are not out of control lunatics doing drugs left and right. You can see somebody like Lindsay Lohan having trouble. You can see someone like Amy Winehouse having trouble. But it's not the same as the sports industry, where people are under contract and working for a certain company for years and years and years. All these people are essentially self-employed.
That's right.
You know, a film studio does not have people under contract. If they make a particular movie with you, they insure it in case you can't complete it. They do not want to go into business with someone who can't complete a film, you know, so they're not interested in booking and hiring someone who they think is going to flame out. So, you know, they make a decision every day about whether they can get the job done, and then they work with them on that one project, and then everybody moves on.
Right. I actually was speaking with somebody who had read Nikki Fink's post and said that in a way she's right, but also in a way the industry does take care of it. Itself with most people who are addicts. Who's working with Lindsay Lohan, for instance? In a way, the industry has taken care of that issue and has said, you know what?
Well, they would if they thought she could make a film and make money for them and get the job done. And, you know, her personal life is her personal responsibility, as it was with Amy Winehouse and Jim Belushi and everybody else. These aren't nannies. These are corporations. If they think you're out of control and won't be able to complete a project, they don't want to sink millions of dollars into it. But they don't care what you do with their private life. It's not their business in a way. And you don't work for them.
But don't you think the industry somehow exacerbates an addiction disease?
Well, do you think Hollywood is awash in out-of-control lunatics who do drugs and self-destructive lives? I don't.
I don't think it's awash, but I do think they certainly make it easier. That the industry itself and the profession in and of itself makes access to drugs and alcohol, makes it a lot easier.
Well, it ain't hard to get a hold of alcohol.
Well, exactly.
Truck drivers on the highway don't have any trouble finding who has crystal meth in what town, or where, you know, where they can get their uppers or their, you know, something to keep them going for another 18 hours on the road. So, you know, I don't think it's unique to Hollywood. It just gets more attention because they're famous.
Now, Russell Brand wrote a post on his own website that says, when you love someone who suffers from the disease of addiction, you await the phone call. There will be a phone call. The sincere hope is that the call will be from the addict themselves telling you they've had enough, that they're ready to stop, ready to try something new. Of course, though, you fear the other call, the sad nocturnal chime from a friend or relative telling you it's too late, she's gone. Addiction is a serious disease. It will end with jail, mental institutions, or death. He goes on to talk about his own his own friendships and his own addiction. And he then says, now Amy Winehouse is dead, like many others whose unnecessary deaths have been retrospectively romanticized at 27 years old. Whether this tragedy was preventable or not is now irrelevant. It is not preventable today. We have lost a beautiful and talented woman to this disease. And he really approaches it as a disease, not something to be ashamed of.
Right. Well, I can appreciate that, those comments. I'm not a big fan of Russell Brand, but I really like what he said there. It's, you know, you help them when you, if they want help, you're there to help them.
Right.
Know? But you can't help them on your own. You know, there's only so much you can do. If they don't want help, there's not a lot you can do.
Right. I mean, I was fortunate enough to get to see Amy Winehouse perform live at Coachella in 2007. So I feel somewhat lucky in that regard. But she only had two albums. That's it. Inevitably, there'll be some material that gets released in the next decade or so.
I doubt there's a lot. I don't think there's a lot in the locker, that's for sure.
But if
it's not like Bob Dylan or Prince, where you got a whole library of stuff, or Michael Jackson even. There's very little there. And she didn't record for very long.
No, and her addiction really prevented her from recording. She was supposed to record the theme song to the next James Bond film. In the end, she couldn't due to her health issues. I watched a lot of that footage or some of that footage from that concert in Belgrade. Have you seen any of that?
No.
As I was watching that, I said to myself, if somebody does not interject, and actually I said it to a number of people around me, if somebody doesn't interject in her life, she is spiraling now out of control in a way that there's only one ending to this because she couldn't stand up.
You can't have her committed.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, can you do?
No,
you can't.
At most, a family can have somebody institutionalized for a few days, depending on where you are and what city, state, or country. And then a court will review and see where they're at. And she would probably be recognized as capable of making her own adult decisions and be freed on her own recognizance. That's how it happened with a friend of mine who didn't want to go on his medications when he had a mental illness. And he's now homeless and lost to us. There's only so much people can do if somebody doesn't want help. I'm not trying to absolve the responsibility of any concert promoter who said, sure, I'll book your act. I would hope I wouldn't do that. But on a personal level, if you're working with her, you're a manager and agent, you just gotta quit and say, you know what, you're not willing to get help and I don't want to pretend this is okay. That's about the most you can do, but you can't make her get better.
Right. And a Dr. Drew Pinsky, who is kind of a well-known psychiatrist. Yeah, I know. He's kind
of a TV personality.
Well, now he is, but he's an addiction specialist, and he for decades before he ever became a TV personality was a psychiatrist and psychologist who worked on a number of issues, and he's kind of become in a way a stereotype of himself. But he was on CNN and saying, look, you know exactly what you're saying, the person themselves has to commit to treatment, and echoed what you said in previous episodes, which is this is not something that can be done in a week, and if it's best to do it over a 6 month to 12-month period of time, if not longer, that they have to check out of their lives, you know, people who are addicted, and really get themselves well before they return to any acting or singing or entertainment career.
I don't think there's any lesson for the industry to learn from this other than a sense of personal responsibility. If you are her manager or an agent of someone that you think is genuinely self-destructive, that at some point to live with yourself, you have to say, I can't work with you anymore. That's about it. You can't make them get better, but you can walk away and say, I don't want to be a part of this. And at least you'll be able to live with yourself.
Right. Well, I know that in Big Deal and or Big Whoop, we actually talk about somebody who people are not walking away from anymore.
Let's get right to it.
All right. Well, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story is about another young singer. The honors for singer Adele keep coming in. Her second album, 21, is on the shortlist for the Mercury Prize, the most prestigious music award in the United Kingdom. The Mercury Prize always highlights an eclectic mix of acts. This year, Adele sits alongside past winners like PJ Harvey and Elbow, as well as newcomers James Blake, the rapper, is it Tiny Tempa?
Tiny Tempa.
And Ghost Poet, as well as Everything Everything, among others. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I love the Mercury Prize. It's a really good snapshot of the UK music scene, and I always use it to try and pick up two or three good acts that are worth checking out. The fact that Adele is the biggest star in the world right now and getting such attention does not mean she is a front runner for the Mercury Prize. It's a quirky award given out by a small panel, so don't assume just because she's a really bad act like she'd be a hot pick for the Grammys. She's not the hot pick for the Mercury Prize. You don't know what they'll pick.
So here's what you missed last week on Glee, which is now actually in reruns. So ironically, there's still stories developing even in reruns. Ryan Murphy, the creator of Glee, said his three main stars would graduate and be gone from the show after season three. Full stop. No guest appearances? No. No cameos? No. Gone goodbye. It only made sense because kids graduate high school and these people are in their mid-20s, for Pete's sake. The actors were bummed to hear about it online rather than from the show themselves, and fans were bummed too. And then, weeks later, another Glee producer says, of course they'll be back. And where did this reporter get their crazy info from? From the creator of the show, Ryan Murphy? Well, that makes no sense because it isn't true, so whatever Murphy said he didn't mean it because it's not happening. Got it? I mean, it's not that confusing, is it? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It's bizarre and confusing. You know, Ryan Murphy spoke definitively to reporters about what was happening with the show. Cast members reacted, even after getting Emmy nominations or talking about the show. 2 weeks later, another producer on the show says, no, that's not true. And literally just keeps insisting, no, it's not true, you got your facts wrong, even though the facts are direct quotes from Ryan Murphy. There's no debate about what he said. It's very bizarre and confusing. I don't know whether they want to keep a mystery as to what happens during season three going or whether they're changing their minds or I don't know what's going on, but it's annoying and tiresome.
PayPal is working with the City of London to fight piracy. As we reported last week, the latest moves to fight piracy seem to avoid the tiresome problem of actually proving a website is engaging in criminal activity by, you know, taking them to court, due process. Instead, media companies accuse a site of being a pirate. The City of London Police Department, quote-unquote, verifies the evidence, though not with a judge or any sort of legal proceeding. And then PayPal agrees to cut off the offending site from its service. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. We're seeing this constant pattern around the globe that because something happens online, you don't have to follow the rules and actually prove somebody's a criminal before depriving them of, you know, basic rights. They're presenting this as just sort of a business transaction between PayPal and clients. They say they're focusing on websites in Russia and the Ukraine. Clearly not talking about 16-year-old kids in Brighton who are downloading the new Adele album, but it's a bad precedent. If they're breaking the law, take them to court and ban them that way. You know, this runaround via PayPal or Visa and MasterCard is very unnerving.
Now, we talked about people who, the industry is welcoming back. Well, this is the story. Charlie Sheen is coming back to TV. We don't know where, we don't know when, but Sheen will be doing a first-run syndicated sitcom based on the movie Anger Management. Like the Tyler Perry sitcoms on TBS, the Sheen sitcom will probably produce 10 episodes, and if they hit a certain ratings target, get a 90-episode pickup. 90 episodes? Yikes. Sheen says he gets a nice chunk of the back end of the show. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for CBS because it gets harder and harder to convince people that Charlie Sheen was a problem if he gets another show and is on another network and is producing a sitcom, you know, and they had him on for all these years and any problems they had with him were well known and well cleared. So I think this is not the purpose of it. Charlie wants to work and make a lot of money, but it certainly helps his court case as well.
That's right. He's making about $100,000 to $200,000 per episode on this new sitcom. And of course, with the back end, it could go well over $1 million per episode.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, that it's a funny system that Lionsgate, I believe, is the company that worked out with TBS on those Tyler Perry sitcoms. And that seems to be what they have in mind here. Get a big commitment up front, make all the shows quickly and cheaply. And then, you know, you've got that guaranteed syndication number of 100, and that's where you make all your dough.
It seems like it would be a good match, the subject, Anger Management and Charlie Sheen. Now, speaking of people who are making money, and especially money in odd ways, James Franco, because he's not doing too much these days, he's hardly ever working. He was an almost invisible presence at the Academy Awards, and now he's taking that same approach to modern art. Franco has collaborated with conceptual art duo Praxis on the non-visible art. They've got a Kickstarter page and have already sold a piece called Fresh Air for $10,000 that amounts to a written description. basically a written description of what the art would be. Hopefully that description is signed since the text there is for everyone to read. Is this a big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, obviously. It's just a goofy little thing. James Franco is having fun. I'm glad to hear it. I know he's going back to General Hospital in the fall, playing the recurring role of a serial killer called Franco. But, you know, they had the text of this piece called Fresh Air and what it was, and it wasn't even well written. It was like literally a paragraph of text. And, I mean, it just was not that well written. And I thought it was a little disappointing and a little sketchy, even for non-visible art.
Borders is shutting its doors, meaning another 11,000 people out of a job and hundreds of storefronts shuttered. How is this affecting the industry? Short term, independent bookstores are worried about Borders selling off its stock at bargain prices. Long term, they see opportunity. But the classical music world sees nothing but disaster, since Borders was the last national retailer that stocked classical music, and it frustrated them for years, however, with its dumb buying patterns. But it was the only game in town, and now classical music, perhaps the genre least digital friendly, has gone almost completely online. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. That's a really good point, that the classical music world in particular really, you know, it was their last great white hope, Borders, which is sad because they were doing such a bad job. I know that one classical label, Harmony Mundi, stopped selling to Borders over a year ago, not because of problems of them paying their debt, but because their buying patterns were so moronic. They would buy they would over-order an album and then return 95% of it, even though Harmony knew the whole time you don't need that many copies. They would not stock a lot of copies in classical centers like New York and San Francisco. They would just put out 4 copies in every store in the country, meaning the big stores would sell out right away and stores in Arkansas would have their dusty copies sitting there for years at a time. I mean, they just drove the classical music people crazy. And you can just see that as a microcosm of why Borders is out of business. It was poorly run. And it's very sad news for classical music because you literally have nowhere to turn to except online to buy classical music.
Just to give you some sense of how badly Borders was run, the day that they were announcing that they were finally folding and liquidating everything, I got an email in the morning that said, you know, bring your ebooks to our ebook reader, the Kobo Reader. And I'm thinking, why would I do that? I just read that you're going out of business. By the afternoon, I got an email from the CEO, a very long email saying goodbye and what had happened. And I thought, how, you know, schizophrenic are you that you're asking me to come and be a customer and yet closing your doors? The squabbling over Michael Jackson's legacy continues. His mother, Catherine, and 4 of his siblings, including LaToya, Tito, Jackie, and Marlon, announced plans for a tribute concert in Cardiff, Wales, of all places, taking place on October 8th. No word on who, if anyone, would actually perform at the concert, but Catherine promised it would be, quote-unquote, fit for a king. Then the Jackson estate piped up and said it knew nothing about this concert and hadn't authorized it at all. Then 2 other brothers of Michael, Jermaine and Randy, said they loved the idea of a concert, but not this one, and not one taking place when Michael Jackson's doctor is on trial for involuntary manslaughter. So is this possible concert a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's definitely a big whoop. It's almost farcical how many different and conflicting statements you have coming out from the Jackson family and estate and brothers and sisters over an event that would seem a no-brainer and one you'd want to do right and properly. It just looks like a mess from the get-go.
Right. Well, and that kind of explains the chaos that Michael Jackson lived in a way.
Talk about another tragedy.
Right. Add Apple to the list of companies approached by Hulu, which has decided to kick the tires and see if a deal makes sense. Apple sells consumers shows episode by episode or at a reduced price for an entire season. Hulu makes them available for free with ads and on more devices if you pay a monthly fee. How much is Hulu worth? Maybe $2 billion, especially if it includes a guarantee that their programming is locked in for the next 5 years. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. All it is Hulu approaching people to try and get them interested in buying them. Apple hasn't said, we're interested, we want to, we're going to. They're just taking a look. So until they show serious interest and until they can figure out whether Hulu's worth anything, you know, I mean, is it worth $2 billion? If that means $400 million a year and in 5 years you have no content left, I don't know.
Well, I mean, do you think that Apple would make a good buyer? Does it seem like a good fit?
It's a very different model from what they do.
Right.
And it makes them, but it's a good fit with what they already offer. You know, they already offer TV shows available piece by piece or season by season without ads. So this is a good complement to that. If they want to be content providers, it's good. But it is rather different from all their other stuff because it's not tied into electronics. It's not tied into anything. It's just a web business.
Right, but they do have Apple TV. Arash Amel kind of agrees with you. He says he's from IHS Screen Digest, and he's their research director for digital media. He says, of course, the natural model for distributing TV shows is ad-supported or subscription-based, not on an individual program rental basis, nor even the episodic purchase model, which is exactly what Apple does.
Right, but this is a business that mimics the traditional buying pattern. So
right.
If he thinks Apple has a bad setup, then they would be right to go into this business, but it doesn't really fit in with their core idea of always promoting Apple products.
Yo, Jay-Z and Kanye West realized that sometimes 1 + 1 = green. See, you thought I was going to say 3, didn't you? I know you thought I was going to say 3, but of course, these savvy hip-hop stars know a good deal when they see one. They're recording together as a duo and dubbing themselves The Throne, with the album Watch the Throne out this year, and now they're launching a full-fledged arena tour, which could make it the biggest hip-hop tour in history. Big deal or big what, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. They're two really talented rap stars. Them being together makes it an incredibly exciting show, you know, one you wouldn't want to miss. I think they're going to bring really good production values to it. I'm excited for the album. They both are sort of at a peak creatively, too. I mean, Kanye's last album was terrific. Jay-Z's album was very good. I'd love to see what they're going to do together.
Netflix is still taking a pounding for its price changes on the company's combined DVD streaming service, probably because of our podcast last week, don't you
think?
That's
right.
Yes. Fans are outraged, but investors are worried enough to sell stock when Netflix's earnings report said future earnings would slow down a little more than expected. Netflix stock peaked at $300 and is now around $288, and the company is still growing. Is this fall in their stock price a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I think anybody who buys or sells stock based on quarterly earnings or slightly reduced earnings growth expected for the next quarter is silly. You're just gambling and playing month to month. If you're investing in a company long term, great. If you think the fundamentals have changed and they're doing a bad business, well, then you should get out. But this game where they set expectations of what they think they'll make, and now they've lowered those expectations, so people are selling stock based on a revised estimate of what might happen in the future. It gets to be just a crazy little game. Look at Netflix. Do you think that their basic business model is bad? I think they're still pretty strong. They might be priced high at $288. I don't know. But, you know, buying and selling stock based on any sort of blip in their earnings is silly. You see film studio stock go up because a movie opens well at the box office.
Well, that's just like the whole gambling thing that everybody says that Wall Street really is. It's just legalized gambling on companies.
Well, if you're only buying week to week or day to day, then yes, it's true.
After 25 years, Oprah is not front and center in the minds of people via her daily afternoon talk show. And that may be hurting her magazine, O. The entire magazine industry was down 7% in August for monthlies. But O is down, advertising-wise, 31.4% in ad sales for the month and down 18.2% estimated for September. Oprah is busy focusing on her cable channel, OWN, but her lack of presence on TV might be dimming her empire. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. You know, she's in a vulnerable place now. I mean, she's not going anywhere. She's a big star. She's going to be on Broadway. But her fundamental properties were always buttressed by the fact that she was on television every day, you know, 365 days a year, practically, it seemed like, on that afternoon talk show. And that's gone. And I think that is going to hurt her magazine and her cable channel and all these other things short term. O is still a very valuable property, but she obviously wants to keep it going, you know, even for long after she's gone. And I'm not quite sure how she does that.
The Toronto Film Festival announced its lineup, and George Clooney looks set to charm the pants off of everyone, just like he did with Up in the Air a few years ago. Clooney will be at Toronto with the backroom politics of Ides of March, which he, by the way, directed, and family drama The Descendants. Two big documentaries include a look at U2's Achtung Baby and Cameron Crowe's fond appreciation for Pearl Jam, not to mention a film directed by Madonna, of all people. Brad Pitt will bring Moneyball. Jane Fonda plays a hippie grandmother in Peace, Love, and Misunderstanding, along with numerous other world premieres. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. It's a nice lineup. I'm very excited to go to Toronto, and if I can make that happen, and check these movies out.
Well, I hope you get to go to Toronto, because I'm thinking of going this year, possibly. We'll see. Who knows? But one thing is certain, we're going to move right along from big deal or big whoop right into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss only the news stories that people in Hollywood might care about. And this week, Michael, you're going to tell us, surprisingly, that Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, the Broadway musical, may be a hit after all.
That's right. There was a flurry of news about Broadway shows in the last few weeks. Three shows announced that they had recouped, that they had, you know, broken even. That's right, on Broadway. It's big news when you don't lose money. Everybody's thrilled. The first production was Ghetto Clown, the one-man show starring John Leguizamo. The second was a star-filled revival of The Normal Heart, which won some Tony Awards. And the third was the play The Mother Effer with the Hat, starring Chris Rock. All three shows made money, went into the black. And not coincidentally, all three were limited engagements that also promptly closed. So they're all off Broadway now. They're gone. They're no longer running.
Well, and how could you lose money on a one-man show?
Well, you can, sure. It costs money to rent a theater, open a theater, you know, tech crew people. It's not free just because there's one person on the show. You might have visual and audio displays, mounting it, tryouts, rehearsals, you know, workshop productions. It costs an average of $2.8 million to bring a play to Broadway. Obviously, that might be less for a one-person show, but it still costs money. You know, you close in 5 days, close a week after opening, you lost money.
That's true.
Right. So looking at that, the announcement may look at the Broadway grosses and see where is Broadway at. It's the middle of the summer in which Broadway attendance is typically down. Fall and winter is where Broadway really shines. Summertime is often when shows sort of start to limp and close. But we're looking at the shows, and there are 24 shows on Broadway now. Seven of them are essentially sold out. They're at 99% or 100% or higher at capacity. And five of those seven new shows are brand new shows to Broadway. That's great news for the long-term health of Broadway. You always want new shows coming in and invigorating it. More than half the shows, 13, are at 90% capacity or higher, which is also good news. So what shows are we talking about? Two of them, The Book of Mormon and War Horse, we've talked about before, they look like long-term blockbusters that are going to be on Broadway for years to come. They have no stars in the cast, so they don't have to worry about when people leave the show. They are in great shape.
What if the horse leaves? What if the horse says, you know, that's it, I'm out of here?
That's right. The horse is played by puppeteers, which is great. War Horse, of course, is a blockbuster play. And that is such a rare thing these days. You know, musicals really shine on Broadway. And most of the plays that come in have big stars who are only there for, you know, 3 months or 6 months. This is a blockbuster play. And you know, the last time that happened on Broadway, Neil Simon's Brighton Beach Memoirs back in 1983. We're talking almost 20 years ago. No play since then has run for more than 1,000 performances. Proof came closest, that ran for 900 performances back in 2000. But that's how rare a blockbuster play is, and that's exactly what War Horse is going to be.
Well, but then you've got Anything Goes and How to Succeed in Business. I mean, we've talked about this before, that who knows what's going to happen with Anything Goes after Sutton Foster leaves, the big star of that show. Daniel Radcliffe is the big star of How to Succeed in Business.
That's right. Though both shows are strong shows. They need big stars to cement them. They don't have to be movie stars, but you need somebody who can deliver and Anything Goes. And it'll be fun to see if people see the show as a name brand or whether they were really there just to see Daniel Radcliffe, a.k.a. Harry Potter, sing and dance, which he does quite well, I should say. And then there's Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
There's always Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, either right. Not being on Broadway or finally opening on Broadway. And now, what's it doing?
Well, for quite a while, it was chugging along, making about $1 million, $1.1 million a week. And we were told it cost about $1 million a week to operate. It's the most expensive show on Broadway, both in terms of its budget and in terms of how much it costs to put the show on every week. There's a ton of people backstage. Then it started to edge up to about $1.3 million. This show's been on since last November, or is it October even? That means it's been on Broadway for about 9 months now, 8, 9, 10 months. People know this show. If there was any bad buzz, if fan feedback was awful, it would have already happened. They didn't need to wait till the reviews came out this summer to think what they knew about the show. Bad reviews had come out in February. Fans knew the show had gotten bad reviews. They didn't care. They kept coming. And as you look at the box office now, the last few weeks, 1.7 million, 1.7 million. And now this week, I think, is a record gross for the show. It's at 1.8 million, just behind The Lion King and Wicked. It's the third highest grossing show on Broadway. It's charging an average of $113 per ticket, so they're not cutting the price. It's at 99% capacity. It's close to its maximum amount that it can make. It's at $1.8 million a week. That's a huge amount of money. If it costs $1 million to put on, that means they're netting $800,000 a week. That means in 1 year, they'll make about $40 million. In 2 years, they'll make $80 million, and they'll be in the black. They will have made their money back.
Well, but after taxes, let's call it, to be conservative, 3 years, they'll make their money back. Do you think the show can last 3 years? Just, you know, being conservative and playing devil's advocate. Three years.
Almost no show ever lasts 3 years. This show probably won't. But it has proved itself with audiences. It's made itself a name brand. Spider-Man is obviously already sellable. People are happy with the show. They are coming. They're coming again. They're telling their friends to go. or wouldn't be increasing in the grosses every week. It's at $1.8 million. You got to check in on it 3 months from now and 6 months from now. But the main thing is they're going to make back a good chunk of their money on Broadway, even if it closes after a year and a half or 2 years. And it's already 9 months into the run. And then they can take it on the road. And their plan was always to make their money on the road. They've turned what could have been a disaster into what could be an audience-friendly, if not commercially, you know, not critically appreciated hit.
Kind of like, you know, Sister Act and Catch Me If You Can. Well, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert was both critically acclaimed. And I'm talking about the movies. I'm not even talking about the fact that they are now Broadway shows.
Well, no, all those shows have gotten mixed reviews. Sister Act, Catch Me If You Can, and Priscilla, there's still question marks as far as shows from the new season. But you have long runners on Broadway like The Lion King and Mamma Mia and Wicked and Jersey Boys, Billy Elliot, Mary Poppins, Phantom of the Opera. They're all chugging along, and Book of Mormon and War Horse are almost certain to join them as shows that will run for 2.5 years or longer, making them some of the biggest hits in Broadway history. And if you can get two shows that proved to be that kind of big blockbuster hit, you can get a couple other shows like Anything Goes and How to Succeed in Business, proving popular for a year or two, and you get some hit plays in and out and they make money, that's a really terrific Broadway season. And really, imagine, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark might in fact be a commercially successful show. Who would have imagined that 3 months ago?
Well, certainly not us. In fact, if you go back and listen to all of our episodes, we talked about Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark quite frequently, as far back as, what, 2 years ago, 2009. You can find all of those episodes, actually, if you really wanted to listen to every single one of them, which we should suggest you do, because all of this information will be on the final. So definitely go to showbizsandbox.com and download all of our episodes. Of course, you can go to iTunes and subscribe there, or you can subscribe in your RSS reader or the Zune Marketplace. All of those links, as well as links to all of the stories we talked about on today's show, all of our past episodes, links to our Twitter account, which is twitter.com/showbizsandbox, or our Facebook account. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Really easy to remember. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can also find ways to email us on the website. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail, and I did record a new voicemail greeting, so give it a listen and let us know what you think. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Usually we will read one of the emails or play one of the voicemails at the end of each show, but we're running a little long today, so we have to move along. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Of course, Michael's work can always be found on the Huffington Post or on his website, michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.